NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
Russia unleashes its biggest missile barrage across Ukraine in months. Plus, we'll look at how a single weapon system is tipping the scales as Kyiv tries to thwart Russia's invasion.
The impact of HIMARS is in the entire military supply chain and means that the operation on the ground is much leaner and much safer.
And Europe dims the lights on tourist attractions in a bid to conserve energy. It's Monday, October 10th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Russia bombarded Ukrainian cities with a series of missile strikes this morning, including the capital Kyiv, which had not been targeted in months. Blasts were also heard in major population centers across the country, including in the western city of Lviv, which had remained relatively insulated from the war raging in the east. Wall Street Journal reporter Ian Levitt in Kyiv has the latest.
So there have been at least four distinct missile strikes in Kyiv across the morning. The first one was about 8:20 a.m. in a park that was about half a mile from the hotel that I was staying at. People are very frightened. I think after the first strike, people were still getting on with their days and were getting onto buses and going to coffee shops. And now the streets are very quiet and the roads are choked with people trying to get out of the city.
And Ian, what has been the Ukrainian response so far?
Ukrainian officials have said that there were at least 75 missiles launched at various sites across the country. The Russians had warned over the last month that they might start hitting civilian infrastructure, which is something that the hardliners in Russia had been encouraging Vladimir Putin to do for months. And it seems like the Ukrainians were prepared for this. There was some expectation that there might be retaliation for the strike on the Crimea Bridge over the weekend.
Today's barrage of Russian attacks on Ukraine appeared in part to be aimed at the country's energy infrastructure, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said. Russian President Vladimir Putin has described Saturday's attack on a critical bridge connecting Russia's mainland to the occupied Crimean Peninsula as a terrorist attack. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged the UN Security Council to consider deploying a special armed mission to Haiti. That call comes amid a deteriorating public security situation that is fueling a humanitarian crisis in the Western Hemisphere's poorest country. Last week, Haiti's prime minister appealed for the immediate deployment of international specialist armed forces in order to break the stranglehold of powerful armed gangs on the country's main port, which has brought critical services, including water distribution, to a standstill. Government officials gathering in Washington this week for the International Monetary Fund and World Bank's annual meetings are being asked to ensure they have enough capacity to respond to future emergencies. The two institutions have reached record lending as they help poor and emerging countries to cope with the pandemic, soaring energy costs, and the fallout from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Rapidly rising interest rates are squeezing the flow of private capital to the world's poorest countries. The problem is that the preferred alternatives, the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, are getting quickly committed. And the Bank of England today offered to buy long-dated UK government bonds in larger amounts and said it would provide continuing support to pension funds that have been at the heart of the UK's bond market crisis. Journal reporter Paul Hannon has more on today's steps.
The interesting thing is that the central bank now sees this as a potentially long-lasting issue for the UK pension fund industry and for the UK gilts market. It's not just something that could be dealt with in a two-week period.
Late last month, the bank launched a series of bond auctions to contain the damage from a furious sell-off in UK government debt over previous days, following a surprise package of tax cuts unveiled by the government. The City of Light is going dark. Paris has begun to shut off the nighttime illumination of some of its most famed monuments, including the Eiffel Tower, as a part of a government call for energy sobriety amid Russia's decision to cut the flow of natural gas to Europe. Plunging the Eiffel Tower into darkness is a highly symbolic step, but will it do much? And will other countries follow suit to help Europe avoid energy disruptions this winter? Joining us with some answers is Wall Street Journal markets reporter Joe Wallace. Hey, Joe, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Luke.
So tell us a bit more about what France is doing here and why they're doing it.
So the government is asking households, companies, municipalities and others to cut their energy consumption by 10% for 2 years. And this is all part of Europe's effort to get through to 2024 or so without Russian gas. So Europe's in for two tough years. And the winter months are particularly difficult. So to try and reduce usage and lower the risk of blackouts or, you know, more widespread economic disruption, the government issued a 50-page plan last week as part of this energy sobriety push. And turning off the lights on the Eiffel Tower is, as you say, a kind of symbolic gesture. I think in its own right, it won't do a huge amount, but it's designed to try to get other businesses and people to do their bit. Other measures include cutting off hot water in public building bathrooms, capping heating at 64 degrees in public buildings, and encouraging people to take steps such as using electrical appliances outside peak consumption hours.
Joe, what's the consensus here? Will this be enough to meaningfully reduce French electricity demand going into the winter? And is it clear whether other countries in Europe are planning their own cuts?
It's such a complex group of measures that no one's quite figured out the extent to which it will reduce demand or not. France's big problem right now isn't just the lack of Russian gas, it's also the fact that half its nuclear power fleet is down. So anything that can be done to reduce power demand, especially at peak times, is going to be of use. Residential demand for gas and power really does account for a huge chunk of overall demand during the winter. So if people really do get behind this, you'd think it could be quite meaningful. And yeah, other countries are taking similar steps. Finland is encouraging people to cut the amount of time they spend on digital devices. Monuments in Germany are going dark. And the Netherlands is encouraging people to shorten their shower times.
That was Wall Street Journal markets reporter Joe Wallace. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Coming up, a single weapon system has transformed the battle for Ukraine, helping Kyiv to thwart Russia's invasion and potentially changing modern warfare in the process. We'll take a closer look at the HIMARS rocket system after the break.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
A single weapon system is transforming the battle for Ukraine, and it's called the M142 High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, or HIMARS. Provided by the U.S. and operated by Ukrainian soldiers since June, HIMARS have dramatically tipped the scales of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia and revolutionized military strategy in the process. And joining us now with more on how HIMARS have altered the battlefield is Journal Brussels Bureau Chief Dan Michaels. Hey, Dan, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Tell us about HIMARS, why this weaponry system has been so important, and what has it really added to the Ukrainian military effort?
HIMARS is notable for two main reasons. It's mobile, that's the M in the name, and it's extremely precise. Precise in a way that previously only things like laser-guided missiles were. And it's precise because of a combination of GPS that's guiding it and advanced microchips in the rockets that it fires. Traditionally, artillery was fired over a broad area very imprecisely. So you would essentially carpet bomb an area with artillery to hit something. But now with GPS coordinates and rockets that are very precise, you can hit the target with one rocket. So the impact of HIMARS is not just on the targeting, but on the entire military supply chain. Because rather than needing 1,000 shells, you can use one HIMARS shell. And this means that not just The weapons system itself is smaller and more precise, but the entire logistics chain behind it, the supply behind it, is completely different. And it reduces the number of soldiers, the number of trucks, the amount of fuel, soldiers necessary to protect all of that gets eliminated, and the operation on the ground is much leaner and much safer because there are fewer trucks, soldiers, weapons, depots for the enemy to hit.
As far as I understand it, Dan, these HIMARS rolled out months ago, and yet most of them remain in use on the battlefield. What has made them so resilient in a war that's seen a lot of military equipment taken offline?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. There are a lot of destroyed tanks and other similar weapons that we've seen pictures of. HIMARS is very mobile. They're on wheels, not on tracks, which means they have top speed more like a truck than a tank. HIMARS is essentially a truck with some weaponry on it and armor. So it can move quickly. And because of the computer systems, it also targets quickly. So what they do is they keep the HIMARS usually hidden under some trees somewhere. Then when they get a target, they drive to another location not far away, point the rocket launcher upwards, fire the rockets, and leave. It's what the military terms shoot and scoot, so that even if the Russians could find out where the HIMARS shot from, by the time they figure that out and are able to send rockets or whatever, the HIMARS is gone.
You mentioned in your recent reporting that the U.S. supplied Ukraine with 16 HIMARS over the summer. It sounds like, from your telling of it, they've had a major effect on the battlefield. Is the U.S. likely to supply more of these weapons?
The U.S. has already said it's supplying another 18, so more than doubling the current number. Now, four of those are supposed to come in fairly short order. The rest will take months, potentially. So it's unclear when they're going to come. But if 16 has had such a big impact, a 25% increase should only help the Ukrainians.
And finally, Dan, does Russia not have comparable technology to the HIMARS that they can be using in Ukraine?
If they do, they only have small amounts of it. The technology that enables HIMARS is, in fact, something that will be very familiar to most people. It's not that different from the technology in a modern smartphone. It's microcircuitry. It's GPS location. I mean, if anybody uses a mapping app on a phone, it's essentially the same thing. U.S. has just packed it into rockets and coordinated with a computer in a truck. So that's what Ukraine is able to do. Russians don't have the microcircuitry. Sanctions now are making it harder for them to get that. But they just haven't had a consumer industry driving this kind of technology. And their military budgets haven't gone into as much high-tech weaponry as the U.S. has.
I guess that's revealing about the state of Russian arms development in some ways.
Russian arms development and the Russian civilian economy, too. It just hasn't emphasized these things because its priorities have been elsewhere.
Dan Michaels is the Wall Street Journal's Brussels bureau chief. Dan, thank you so much for the update.
Good talking with you.
And finally, for years, the streaming service Netflix has broadly resisted showing its films in cinemas. And when it has, it usually did the bare minimum to qualify for awards competitions like the Oscars, which require films to receive a limited run in real-world movie theaters. But Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krauss, who covers Netflix and the streaming industry for us, says that Netflix's release plan for the upcoming sequel to murder mystery Knives Out, which will involve a month-long run in up to 600 theaters before the film hits streaming, marks a major departure from precedent.
It suggests that there's like a bit of a truce between Netflix and theater chains like AMC that in the past have not carried the streamers' films because they said that they didn't comply with the theatrical windows that they wanted to see for the films that they did release. Another layer of the tension or the debate is that the creative talent and directors often want to see their films, you know, their name and lights and their films on the big screen, that sort of traditional Hollywood debut. And that's something that Netflix has had to sort of negotiate with talent on.
And that's What's News for Monday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.